Tonight on Arena with me, Ciara King. Wicked for Good, Train Dreams and Testimony are our films up for review, and a new production of The Bartered Bride with the INO. And as always, you can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 087-032-3232. You can email us to arena@rte.ie, and we're on Instagram @rte_arena. Now, it is Thursday and it's that time of the week when we review this week's big new film releases, and there are three up for critique this evening. First up is Wicked for Good, the continuation of the prequel to The Wizard of Oz. Next up is Train Dreams, a film about 19th century loggers in rural America, starring Joel Edgerton and William H. Macy. And third but not least is a new Irish documentary by Aoife Kelleher, looking at the campaign to tell the stories and right some of the wrongs of the Magdalen laundries. And I'm delighted to be joined by Cara O'Doherty and Justin McGregor with their reviews of all three films. So let's begin with Wicked for Good. It's the second part of the prequel story. It's based on the smash hit Broadway show telling the origin stories of the witches from The Wizard of Oz. The Witch of the East is Elphaba and the Good Witch is Glinda. And in this film, there's a love triangle with a prince who both witches are in love with. Jeff Goldblum also makes an appearance as an evil wizard. But Cara, I'll start with you. For those who don't know what this is all about, and you'd want to be living under a rock, by the way, not to have known what's been going on with Wicked for the last 2 years. Where are we and what world is this, and how big has this franchise become?
I mean, this franchise is monstrous. Started out as one of the longest running shows ever on Broadway. The film, the first film adaptation, is the highest grossing musical adaptation so far that we've ever had. People are obsessed with Wicked. I count myself as one of them. I've seen the stage production 3 times, so a bit of a mega fan here. For people who have been living under that rock, it's basically the origin story, as you say, of Glinda and Elphaba, the two witches. In the first film, we meet them as college students. Elphaba is an outsider because she is green, which doesn't really fit with the rest of society. And Glinda is this perfect, gorgeous, pink socialite who just wants everything to be lovely. And despite the fact that they're very different, they become great friends. But there is a problem in Oz, and that is that the wizard is actually not very nice. Animals talk in this land and he has been banishing them. Things have been going very wrong, and Elphaba is very much standing up for those. So by becoming wicked, what she's actually doing is becoming an activist to save people, but that is not how she is cast by propaganda. So the two of them split at the end of the last film, although they know they're both good. The rest of the world can't see that.
Okay, and Justin, I want to talk about the press tour around Wicked 1 and Wicked 2. Now, I remember last year the press tour was on and it almost nearly put me off going to see Wicked, I'm not going to lie. And this time round, you know, I read on the internet, I thought it was really funny, Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande remind me of two trauma-bonded sphinx cats. There seems to be a little bit of energy kind of around the two of them. But what are they like? Tell me about their roles. Is the chemistry, does it still exist in the second Wicked movie? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. I mean, there are times, I mean, Cynthia's voice is so amazing. There's a couple of duets where Ariana Grande is clearly maybe struggling a bit to keep up. But what they've done is they've just kind of clearly delineated the character. The Glinda the Good, she has a big song and dance number about being, you know, being good. And the Wicked Witch, who is being cast as the Wicked Witch, we really see like her true side and her true nature, especially in her interactions with animals. But I agree, like the marketing of these films, I mean, I know with films like Frozen, the marketing budget's bigger than the filmmaking budget, because that's how they operate and that's how they kind of run it. And it must be very tiring on the soul to give the same interviews, the same questions over and over again. And if there's any interpersonal conflicts, that can't be good for one's well-being.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Cara, the always brilliant Jeff Goldblum. I've heard some mixed reports about his performance in this movie. He plays the evil wizard, or sorry, maybe in the first movie. Does he ham it up in this movie, or is there like a certain, does he bring nuance to the role?
I mean, he always kind of ham things up a little bit. I mean, Jeff Goldblum at this point plays Jeff Goldblum. As a wicked purist, I should say, I think he has a little bit more to do in this, and I don't think we need him having more to do. I think he's perfect in small doses. But one particular routine, it's just dragged out and you're like, "We no, you're fine. We have enough of you now." Like literally perfect in small doses, but we don't need quite so much of him.
Okay, now Justin, Jonathan Bailey, people will know him from Bridgerton and from the first film of Wicked. And he's back playing the handsome prince. He was recently voted the world's sexiest man. Is he more than a pretty face in this movie?
He is, you know, I haven't seen the stage show, but I've heard that his part's been majorly expanded in, certainly in the sequel. And it's great for him to have more to do because I think it really fleshes out the love triangle and the complexity of it. And I mean, even the nuance inside that love triangle that Ariana Grande's Glinda doesn't necessarily, I wouldn't say she's in love with him. She thinks she should be in love with him. So there's some nice sort of work for him to be able to do. And I think his scenes, though, with Elphaba are amazing.
OK, well, like, do you know really what? Good. We have a clip of, is it Furio? It's Prince Furio.
Fiero.
Okay, Fiero. Prince Fiero, and played by Jonathan Bailey, and Glinda, played by Ariana Grande.
You can't leave because you can't resist this. That's the truth.
Well, maybe I can't. Is that so wrong? I mean, who could?
Well, you know who could. We both know who could and who has. And I have to find her, because if someone else gets there first,
you know, I'm worried for her, too. And I miss her. Can't you see? She doesn't want to be found. You've got to face it. She's made her choice.
And now, Cara, we have characters from Dorothy's Wizard of Oz popping into this one. Tell me about that, because they didn't appear in the first one.
No, they didn't. So it does follow along with the stage production bit by bit. Characters appear. Now, we're not going to say how they appear, but let's just say that the Tin Man finds his way. The Cowardly Lion appears. And we also have the Scarecrow as well. I'm very interested. What's clever with Dorothy is we never get to see Dorothy's face. And she's played very much as this kind of side character, because we meet her when Glinda is saying, yeah, follow the Yellowbrick Road, you're fine. So it's a lovely way of bringing her in, but it doesn't dominate. So for people who love the story, they have this nice little Easter egg there, but it doesn't become a huge part of it.
Okay, and Justin, the film, is it essentially a love triangle between two women vying over a prince, or is it a love story between two friends? How does that play out?
I think it plays much more as a love story between two friends, which is one of the things that's really interesting about it, especially the end, like the last sort of 20-30 minutes when their friendship is really at the fore. Fiero is basically off screen and kind of somewhere else, and it really becomes very much about them and what they're willing to do, and you know, what they're willing to sacrifice for Oz and for the animals and the community outside of the wizard who they want to leave. And they just do it really well from at the end, sort of when Dorothy and the gang appears. We know from the Wizard of Oz, we know what happens. It's all seen from, she's inside a cupboard and we can just see shadows, and the shadows are miming the fight just like it is in the Wizard of Oz, and it's just really, really well, really well done. And we get to see her emotion of what she's watching.
And we can't talk about Wicked 2 without talking about the music and the songs. Now, they're incredible in the first movie. How do they hold up in the second movie?
Oh, I think they're almost better. I think because the second half of the musical is dominated by For Good, which is the most beautiful song. And again, not to harp on about me, I haven't seen it three times, but this is the way they do it, and this is more beautiful than I've ever seen it done on stage. It's beautiful, it's powerful, and I'm not afraid to say that I did shed a tear or two in the back of the cinema, hiding from my fellow critics so they wouldn't see me sniffling. It's just beautiful. There's also a lovely song that Elphaba and Fiero share in the stage production. His part isn't as long in it, and as Justin has pointed out, Fiero has more to do, so fans will love the fact that he is more involved in this particular duet, and it again is quite magical.
Okay, so the important question to ask is, are super Wicked fans going to be happy with this?
Absolutely, yes. And yeah, I have to take the critic side out a little. It is too long. There's some repetitive scenes there. It is not perfect, but it is beautiful. And when it's good, it's spectacular, and Wicked fans will love it despite the flaws.
Okay, how many stars?
I had to fight with myself, but I'm going with the four.
for, okay, Justin.
Yeah, no, there's a nice twist too at the end that's not in the book or the stage production, which people will really love. Yeah, I gave it 4 stars. I mean, what can you say?
Well, okay, well, that's a very good review, in fairness, you know. Okay, so 4 stars for Wicked 2. Now, to a smaller film, at least in stature, starring Joel Edgerton and William H. Macy, Train Dreams is based on a novella from 2011, and it brings us to the heart of logging country in the early 20th century and the workers clearing the forest to make way for the railroads and bridges. This is a film where I wish that I'd read the book first. Had either of you read the book?
No.
No. Yeah. And you know, it's funny because I watched Trespasses recently on Channel 4, and that was another show that I watched that I kind of wish I'd read the book beforehand. So, Justin, this film couldn't be any more different to Wicked. What is the story of Train Dreams?
It's really the story of what our role is in the world, told through a person trying to find their way in the world. So we have this character played by Joel Edgerton, Robert Grainier, and it's really just about his life. But it's the small things in life, the small friendships, the small connections you make. It's about love and loss. And it really is just him trying to find, why am I here and what's going on? And it's very, very low key. I mean, some big things happen, but it's told in a very human way. There's no big melodrama. You sometimes think things are going to happen, which I think was maybe the nice side of not having read the novella, because there's kind of this second relationship and you think, oh, is this going to go somewhere? No, it's not. It's actually just a friendship that's just formed over this kind of shared grief that the two characters have. So it's really a meditation on life. And when you're on the journey of life and you get to the end, what did it mean for you? You know, and so they use the voiceover, which I know is taken very much from the novella, which gives a really strong flavor to what the novella was like and does make you definitely want to sort of pick it up and read it. And that's done by Will Patton, who usually plays a villain in most movies. And it's very, even the delivery of the narration is very slow and gently paced. You know, there's no rush for the story to get anywhere. And then at the end, yeah, it's just, it's marvelous. It has a sort of rumination when he finds his place, but in sort of this most unexpected way.
I thought it was so visually beautiful.
Oh.
Kind of very slowly sad, if that makes sense. And the brilliant William H. Macy, he plays one of the loggers. Kara, he's always a star turn. Do you think that he stole the film, or do you think that he just played the character just right?
Oh, I think he slightly stole it. I mean, Joel Edgerton is beautiful in this. He's so mournful and so just so quiet and this rugged man who just doesn't have many words. And it's a beautiful turn by him. But William H. Macy is special in this moment. His character's a little bit of wackiness there. He's a little bit odd. And it was very beautiful and very much that sort of kind of oddball that you meet along life's journeys. But they're lovely and they're interesting. So it's a gorgeous turn by him.
Let's have a listen to a clip. This is William H. Macy as Aaron Peepers.
This is rough work, gentlemen. Not just on the body. We just cut down trees that have been here for 500 years. Upsets a man's soul whether he recognizes it or not. You think that she knows that I'm her daddy?
Deep down, she knows it. Even if she doesn't know, she knows it yet.
And Justin, there is this love story. Robert meets Gladys. Gladys is played by Felicity Jones. What happens, without giving us away any spoilers?
That's a tough one. Their love story is just, again, it's so very gentle. They just sort of start. He starts going to church. She meets her outside of church one day, and then he starts going to church so that he can see her. And they just slowly build this relationship. And there's just this wonderful scene where he's lying on the riverbank and she says, what do you think about it? He says, I'm thinking we should get married. And she has this great response, as we already are, but let's have a ceremony for it to make it official. And it's just this very natural relationship, and it fits very much in the tone of the whole film, because nature is also such an important part of the film and our relationship to it, them as loggers destroying it, and then him with his family trying to survive in it and sustainably, I suppose. And it does take a sad turn, unfortunately, and him dealing with that turn is such a big part of the film. And it's not till he meets Kerry Condon's Claire that he's finally able to just say these few little things that are absolutely heartbreaking about what he's gone through to make it to this point in life.
And even with Felicity Jones' character Gladys, you know, they have a little girl called Kate, and she has to wait for him while he heads off to work on these railroads, and you can really feel her frustration as well with her wanting to be with him all the time, you know. I think we have a clip here of Robert, played by Joel Edgerton, and Gladys, Felicity Jones.
Beautiful, ain't it?
What is?
I didn't think you'd be on this soon.
Well, I just couldn't stop walking until I got here.
What are you thinking about?
I was thinking that we ought to get married.
And Justin, you mentioned there's an Irish connection, Kerry Condon. Cara, what did you make of her appearance in the movie?
Kerry Condon is always wonderful, no matter what she does. And once again, she is fantastic here. She's not using her Irish accent, which we know her, that she really fights for that, but obviously it wouldn't fit with this film. And she's very good with the old American twang. She's just lovely. She's very grounded. She's very earthed. There's a bit of mystery about her. We're not quite sure of why, where she's come from or what's making her do. Which she's a fiercely independent woman working in a world that wouldn't have been a woman's job at this time. So, well, there's a mystery to her as well. She's got this gorgeous connection to the just so earthed. So and she's a lovely her with Joel Edgerton. They're quite lovely together.
Do we reckon there's Oscar noms in Joel Edgerton's future?
I think so.
Well, there's a pause there, guys. So
it's hard because. The performance is so subtle. My experience with the Oscars is they go for the, you know, greed is good, Gordon Gekko sort of moments. And it's so subtle, people might miss the kind of wondrousness of how the narration, you're hearing the narration over top and you're seeing Joel Edgerton going through that inner turmoil in a really remarkable but incredibly subtle way. And the sparsity of his dialogue, all of their dialogue, but they reveal so much with just very, very few words.
So how many stars are we talking?
I'm going with a 4 again for this. It's really beautiful. It's quite heartbreaking and yet it's so subtle and quiet. It's going to be nominated for cinematography and possibly screenplay and that kind of thing.
Okay.
It's just, he's so subtle. I don't know if people will pay attention.
Gotcha, Justin.
I gave it 4.5. Again, gentle, subtle, just good.
Really okay, good. Amazing. All right, well now on to our final film, and it's a very important Irish film, and it's about a very important Irish story. It's made by the director and documentary maker Aoife Kelleher, and it's a documentary about the activists and survivors of the Magdalen Laundries. Cara, remind us of the other work that Aoife Kelleher has done, and why did you want to make this particular film?
She made 1 Million Dubliners, which is a fascinating,
incredible,
and the beautiful documentary about Mary Robinson that she made last year, Mrs. Robinson, which is a fantastic look at Mary Robinson's life and career. Aoife Kelleher is this. I love the work that she does because she takes a really sensitive, subtle approach. She doesn't prod her interviewees. She doesn't over sensationalize. She allows them to have their say in a very beautiful, very restrained way, which I just think is wonderful. I just think she makes beautiful work, and this is a perfect example of that.
And Justin, what was I going to say to you at all? Obviously, there's been much telling and retelling of the stories. Okay, you know, what has happened in these homes, everything from States of Fear to Philomena to small things like these. What new element do you think does this documentary bring?
Well, I think it's in the title. Like, it really is, you know, their case that they brought for the Magdalen Laundries and then the mother and baby homes was very much about gathering testimony and letting these survivors tell their story and recording it and building testimony of what had actually gone on. And the documentaries, they have very subtle, because it really just is about them telling their story. And even Philomena, who's in the film, she still brings something new to the story, though she's had a whole feature told about her story. So she just gives them that space to kind of record what they've done. I mean, for me, it struck me as something that I think I put somewhere in my notes. Like, this should be on the Leaving Cert, like,
absolutely,
in the nearest possible future, because it just contains so much Irish history and really, really important events in it. And it does it through the unquestionable testimony of the people who were there.
And you mentioned Philomena, and I actually was surprised, you know, when I saw her pop up in this film, and then I was like, no, but of course she should be there and whatnot. Tell me about some of the other women and their story in this film, Cara.
I mean, that's just extraordinary. Madeleine Marvier, I might be saying her surname wrong, but that she's absolutely extraordinary. She was in Best Buried Mother and Baby Home when she was just 17, and she had her baby son there, William, who died shortly afterwards. And she was told that William was buried in the grounds of Bessborough. There is, I think, is it, sorry, I'm going to get the figures wrong now. There's several hundred, 900 children who are buried in Bessborough, and there's only a record of where 64 are buried. So she knew he was there, but that was it. She didn't know where exactly. And years later, she found out that she was lied to and that he was, in fact, placed in a mass famine grave at Carr's Hill, a very different part of Cork. And again, there's no record of where he is. And she goes there walking, hoping that, you know, some, she might just feel a connection of where he is. And it's heartbreaking. This woman is, she's in her 70s. The pain is still there. It's so strong. And it is just devastating to think that she has no idea where this poor baby is. Mm-hmm. And she's just one of thousands of women. There's also an amazing woman who sadly died last year, Mary Steed. And she was this incredible, incredible activist. She, again, was born in Cork, and she was adopted without consent and sent to America to a new family. And in the States, she brought hundreds of people together online through communications, and she worked really strongly to help survivors access redress, to help find family members. There's so many women who are telling their stories like this, remarkable, remarkable people for what they've gone through and how they've kind of held it together.
And there were so many standout moments in the film for me. And there was one woman, I think her name was Mary, and she was in the mother and baby home at Tuam. And she talked about how when she was in there, that she used to iron John Wayne's shirts and Maureen O'Hara's blouses. And when I go home, I always pass the Quiet Man Bridge. So for me, it now has taken on, you know what I mean, a different meaning. It's 2025. We're heading into 2026. Like, how important is it that we continue to hear these women's stories?
Oh, it's so important. I mean, one of the things that really jumps out is, you know, the governments that have been brought this testimony, the resistance to really acknowledging fully, you know, what's gone on. And they talk about running these sort of shadow investigations so that they can have this testimony to go with the government. And there's something really frustrating about that reluctance and that hesitation. So I think there's so many lessons here, not just from the past, but how do we go forward? How do we have full reconciliation if there's this hesitancy of telling the truth and saying, like in the mother and baby homes, they said there was no real evidence. And the lawyer for Hogan Lovells, who provided 50 pro bono lawyers to the mother and baby home case, said, you know, when you interview all these people and they say the same thing, that is evidence.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't need a photo or a confession, like that's evidence.
Stars.
It's a funny one to give stars to.
See, that's how I feel when I just said that to you. Yeah,
but 4 stars, really, it's excellent. And like Justin says, this is something that needs to be seen by everybody without doubt. Powerful stuff.
Yeah, I mean, same with stars. I mean, the content is obviously 5 stars. I mean, formally, it's a very traditional documentary, recreations and talking heads, but the content is just unbelievable.
Yeah, no, it is. Cara O'Doherty and Justin McGregor, thank you so much for your views this evening. And Wicked for Good is on general release now. Train Dreams is at selected cinemas as well as Netflix. And Testimony is out in cinemas this Friday. I implore you go and see it. Welcome back. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Now, the Irish National Opera are taking a comic work on tour as of this Saturday. The Bartered Bride is a Czech opera from the 19th century. It's a tale of two families and a marriage broker. And the bride in question has her own ideas, however, and a lover that she much prefers to the bridegroom on offer. And I'm delighted that Fergus Shiel, Artistic Director of the INO, joins me now in studio. Very nice to talk to you, Fergus.
Thanks very much, Ciara.
Now, who is Smetana, am I getting that right?
That's
am I
right, pronouncing Smetana, that right? Yeah, he's one of the most beloved of the 19th century Czech composers. A bit like Dvořák, who'd be a little bit better known. But it's really beautiful music. It's very melodic. It's full of dance rhythms. It's inspired by folk music. So there's a lot of dancey, sort of folky elements to it. Very lyrical, very, very beautiful.
And do you know what? Let's start off. Let's hear a little bit of Smetana. Smetana, there you go. It's in my head now. Let's hear a little bit of Smetana's music now. Would you introduce the dance of the comedians?
Yeah, so this is an instrumental part of the opera where there's a travelling circus that comes to town in Act 3, and this piece of music is their kind of signature tune for the circus.
So that was Smetana's Dance of the Comedians. So not only do we have a circus and meddling families and a marriage broker, as I said, we just turned a circus there now into the mix. Irish soprano Amy Ari is Marinka, am I right? The bride of the title.
That's right, yeah.
Why is she so opposed to the match of the marriage broker that is killing himself trying to arrange?
Yeah, well, so there's two families, as you said, and the role of the matchmaker is very funny. It's sung by John Molloy, who's a very comedic singer. And he is basically trying to stitch Amy up with this young guy called Vashek, who's very shy and has a stammer. But the two families have to sort of get together because one owes money to the other, and this is a way of settling debts, and everybody will be happy if this marriage goes ahead, except Mazhenka herself, because she's in love with another guy. And so the whole thing is her trying to thwart the plans of her parents and her future parents-in-law and the marriage broker, and everybody's railed up against her and against her true love. And there's lots of sort of hilarious twists and turns where she thinks that her real lover has bartered her, like he has accepted money to go away and get out of the picture. And so everything looks as if it's going wrong at one point, but there's a few more twists. I won't spoil the ending to you, because it's really great sort of how it all sort of unfolds towards the end.
I think that we really need comedy right now in our entertainment, and it's funny.
It's really funny, and the setting is hilarious. It's kind of, we've set it in Ireland in the 1960s in a sort of a country and western style where Big Tom is an influence. So the costumes are hilarious. Joan O'Cleary's done an amazing costume design, and everybody, there's 11 singers, but they're all doing about three roles each. So there's, I don't know where we were putting all the costumes, because every moment they're coming out looking like something else out of the 1960s or 70s. Very funny, very colourful. And then it's set in this kind of bar and barn dance kind of feel to it, like that music you've just heard. You can imagine people having a good time, jumping around. So yeah, it's great. Like, we did so many comedies earlier this year. We did Fledermaus, we did Elixir of Love. So many people in the audience came up to me and said thank you for doing, you know, just giving us a little bit of escapism and something very entertaining that, you know, when you go, and this will be on tour around the country, communities come together, enjoy it, and have a bit of fun.
And even though it is a Czech opera from the 19th century, as you said there, you know, it's set in kind of 1960s, you know, Ireland, it could be set in 2025 as well. It could be set kind of anywhere in the world, because there's always going to be meddling families and a circus here and there, and a marriage deal that you might not want to go through with.
Yeah,
you know?
And money and power and, you know, young people having to sort of thwart the ambitions of their parents and just do their own thing in life.
Do you know what? Let's listen to some more music. This is Marinka's aria from Act 3, Scene 5. Again, could you give us the context for this?
Yeah, so this is a beautiful and sorrowful aria. This is where she thinks that her true love has abandoned her for money. And she's reflecting, and she's saying things like, I can't believe that this love that I believed so much in, it turns out not to be real.
Stop.
Now, in this production, the cast, as you can hear there, is singing in English with Richard Pearson conducting and Louise Miller directing. Apart from Amy Niari, who else is on stage?
Oh, we have an amazing young Ukrainian tenor, Igor Shuravsky, who's like a real hotshot internationally, and he's come to sing this role. We have a whole range of Irish singers. We have people like John Molloy, I mentioned. We have some young singers, Megan O'Neill, Matthew Mannion, Ben Escorcio. And then we have people like David Howes, who's making a big career internationally, Carolyn Holt and Mezzo. So there's lots of names there. Julian Close, who sings in the Metropolitan Opera in New York. Like, we have people who are singing at the best opera houses. So it's a really top-notch ensemble cast. They're very busy all the way through, all of them.
And speaking about orchestras and whatnot, this set, you've created this production that can tour to kind of smaller venues, so no orchestra pit is needed.
Yeah, so we've made an arrangement of it for five instruments. It's directed from the piano by Richard Pearson, and then there's also a violin, clarinet, cello and French horn. And this ensemble creates the entire world. And the idea behind this tour was that we're going to venues that we've never been to before. So all seven performances are in new venues for Irish National Opera, because we really, I mean, we have this ambition where we want to tour to every county in Ireland every year. We won't quite get to everywhere, but we've been 30 places so far in the last 8 years. And so this is spreading our love of opera wider. And a lot of these venues are small. They don't have orchestra pits. So we've put the orchestra on stage and they're really part of this whole community. So you have a community of singers and musicians. And it's like you've gone to a cave or something like that, that there's some musicians in the background playing.
And also it's kind of making opera more accessible to everyone else in the country, because a lot of the time, to be fair, you have to travel to the big cities to see the operas and whatnot. So this, you're kind of heading out there
exactly, yeah,
to Ireland and giving everyone a taste.
And that's really what we want to do, and that's why we're supported by the Arts Council. So we feel it's public money. People in Leitrim have paid for us as well as people in Dublin, so we want to go there. And we've also been supported by a very generous donor, Lord Laidlaw, who's helping get the, you know, particularly wants us to go and visit communities where people have not heard opera or don't get opera live very regularly. So we're very excited about that.
Well, Fergus Shiel, Artistic Director of INO, thank you so much. INO's The Bartered Bride goes on tour from the 22nd of November to the 6th of December. It opens in Axis Ballymun, then it goes to Mullingar Arts Centre in Westmeath, the Garage Theatre in Monaghan, Burr Theatre and Arts Centre Offaly, the Glens Arts Centre, Manor Hamilton in Leitrim, Ballina Arts Centre in Mayo and Remore Arts Centre in Virginia Cavan. Further details at irishnationalopera.ie. Welcome back to Thursday Night's Arena with me, Ciara King. Now, he was football's first superstar. Manchester United's number 11 was blessed with pace, precision passing, ball control, as well as huge charisma, both on and off the pitch. Belfast-born George Best changed the face of football forever. This month marks 20 years since his death, and a special screening of a film made at the height of his powers will take place at the National Concert Hall in Dublin next week. Football as Never Before by German filmmaker Helmut Kustard focuses exclusively on Best, following his every move during a 1970 match at Old Trafford. There will be a live musical accompaniment to the film, and one of the composers, Matthew Nolan, joins me this evening. Matthew, how are you?
I'm very well, and thank you so much for having me, Ciara.
Now, I'm really excited to talk to you about this, because I watched this earlier on today and I have so many questions, but can you tell me first how you first came across the film Football as Never Before?
Well, it's almost a lost film in some regards. You know, Helmut Kustard was an obscure avant-garde German filmmaker in the 60s and 70s. He passed away about 25 years ago, but most of his work was made in the 60s and 70s. I saw it at a German film festival in the IFI about 25 years ago in Cinema One with about three other people. So that was my first exposure to it, you know, many, many, many moons ago.
And can I ask you as well, are you a Man United fan? Were you a fan of George Best?
I'm a massive George Best fan, but I'm actually a Liverpool fan.
Oh, that's interesting. Controversial,
yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah. They're not mutually exclusive, although some people might think they are.
That's fair. Tell me, why was George Best important to you?
I think that for me, growing up, like, I was born in the early 70s and, you know, became kind of obsessed with football as I hit the 80s. And, you know, most of my understanding of football came from, you know, uncles and people who talked about the game, because I wasn't really exposed to it. There wasn't stuff you could really watch on television as a kid. There wasn't the exposure that we have now in terms of kind of media access. But George Best you know, was central to all of these kind of narratives about, you know, football, as I heard them from, you know, uncles and older people. And there's this mythology that just built up around him. You know, I didn't even know what he looked like, but I knew that he was brilliant at football. I knew that he was Irish. I knew that he'd achieved huge success with Manchester United. And then I think then as I got a little bit older and became, you know, more aware of his prowess on the football field, I was able to see it for myself, you know, across the 80s and then into the 90s as all of this kind of footage became more accessible. I realized that the beginnings of my relationship with him, he had this kind of mythic kind of status. It also helped that my mother was obsessed with him too. So that
I think a lot of women were. I think that's fair.
They certainly were, yeah. Like he was a pop culture icon as well as a footballing icon.
He was kind of the original football superstar, wasn't he? I'd say even more so than Pele.
Very much so. I think, you know, something about when he emerged in the 60s in England, things were changing, youth culture was changing, you know, pop culture as we know it was definitely evolving. And it's why when people talk about Best, they often mention the Beatles. I mean, he was referred to as El Beatle, you know, often. And sometimes I find it hard to separate him from that culture and put him back into a footballing context. And then when I have him in a footballing context, I find it hard to separate from that and think about, you know, his place within, you know, a very kind of changing cultural landscape in the 60s and 70s.
I grew up in the 90s with a younger brother who was absolutely obsessed with Man United, so much so that we had two cats. One was called Becky after David Beckham. The second was called Busby after Sir Matt Busby. And if we'd had a third, it probably would have been George Best. So even, you know what I mean, your experience growing up in the 70s, my experience growing up in the 90s, George Best was so prevalent. Like everyone knew who he was, you know. Mm-hmm. But as you said, we knew who he was from a footballer point of view, but also kind of towards the end, it was more the tabloids and, you know, obviously his drinking and whatnot. But I want to, because I don't think I've ever seen anything like what I watched today. And I want to bring us back to the original making of the film Football as Never Before by Helmut Kustard in 1970. It's a very unique take on George Best, let's say.
It is. It's like watching the film is like being caught up. It's like a trance film, you know. It's almost hallucinatory because it's unfolding in real time. It doesn't adhere to any of the usual kind of TV sporting conventions that we're all so used to now in 2025. It's all so kind of codified and, you know, we're told what to look at and almost when to cheer. But in this context, you know, because the camera follows Best around and so much of the action happens off camera, you're kind of asked to consider him in a different light. You're not watching a football match as such. It's almost as like, well, this is a guy who's, you know, this is his work, in a sense. You know, how he's relating to, you know, some of the other footballers, his sense of isolation on the football pitch as well. All of these things kind of start to float past your mind's eye as you watch it, you know, unfold before you. And it is, it's because it's experimental film and it's this really unusual collision of, you know, soccer as kind of populist cultural form and experimental cinema. It's not often that these two worlds collide like this.
No, as I said, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this. And there's a lot of close-ups. Basically, it's an hour and 40 minutes of close-up shots, lingering shots of George Best on certain parts of his body. He's staring into the camera at halftime at Old Trafford. The camera, it's kind of insisting on an intimacy with him.
It's almost erotic in places and quite fetishistic when you think about just how the elements of parts of his body that it does focus on and lingers on for like 30, 40, 50, 60 seconds. Very unusual to see a male form presented in that way in any kind of cinema, but a sporting icon like that. So it's an unusual position to be put in as a spectator.
And that's what I found, because I found like 20 minutes in, I thought it was really kind of meditative, actually. And then, you know, obviously the way that it's set up, you've got the sound of the crowd in the background and the camera is always on George Best. It's 1970, it's Man United versus Coventry. And suddenly I began to see things about George Best, like how glossy his black hair was, okay? Mm-hmm. His legs.
Yes.
The number 11 on the back of his jersey and the fact there was no sponsorship on the football jersey. And then suddenly I would kind of zone into the crowd who were in the background and I felt like I was sitting in an art gallery watching an art installation.
Yeah, I think it is partly that, isn't it? And the way it's been presented over the years, we've done it in art galleries, we've done it in cinemas, we did it in theatres. The last time we did it was actually in Daly Mount Park. 6 years ago, it was part of a conference that TU Dublin organised on football and aesthetics, would you believe? And we put a giant screen in the middle of Daly Mount Park, and we watched this film unfold with an audience in the stand. And that became quite a visceral experience. But it was like being at a football match, but not the kind of football match you've ever seen before, or the kind of perspective you're being kind of almost relentlessly kind of asked to take or to assume. And I kind of love it for that. And I think talking about it as a form of meditation is just wonderful, because that's how I feel about it. Mm-hmm.
And as you said, the original film is to be shown at the National Concert Hall, and it's going to have live musical accompaniment, which you've composed with Brian O'Connell. Tell me about a piece of music, and we'll play some to give people a sense of it.
Well, the music, I guess the show has had an interesting kind of life from its first presentation to then its kind of second, third and fourth kind of iterations. But we don't play all the time. We only play for about 40 to 45 minutes of the whole film. I'm very sensitive to the fact that the original crowd noises and the singing that happens and that sound world is really important to creating a sense of space and place and occasion. But there are times across the film where the camera perspective shifts, drops down to eye level, and everything becomes a little bit more lyrical. You feel like you're closer to best. That's when we play music. So over the course of the film, there's probably three or four different approaches that we've adopted. Some of the music is very slow, very meditative, very spacious. Some of it is very rhythmic and driven. It's almost like we're trying to mark time and kind of create a kind of rhythmic flow, you know, that reflects how best moves on the pitch, and also, you know, for the audience to keep them kind of interested and sewn in. And there are a couple of big set pieces that that utilize, you know, kind of percussive motifs that form the heart of what we're doing in terms of the music that we've created. Mm-hmm. Then others are just more meditative, more almost requiem like, because, you know, this. You know, for me, this is a kind of tribute to a childhood hero. So it's really emotive. So, you know, we move through all of these different kind of phases of, you know, big percussive, like music that's very reflective, actually, of the kind of progressive rock and experimental music that was being made in Germany in the early 1970s. We kind of took that as our cue and partial kind of inspiration.
All right. Do you know what we'll do? I think we've got a clip of a piece of music. This is called Final Whistles.
Okay.
That was just a taste of Final Whistle. And even while the music was playing there again, I went off into this meditative state that I did when I was watching, you know, the film earlier today. What was the thinking? This is something that I noticed. the interweaving of that music and then the sound of the crowd kind of coming in and out, like it really kind of created this beautiful art piece again. You know, I'm saying it again. What, you know, was there thinking behind that or?
There was. I think we always wanted to have that, you know, that sense of place and the sound world that exists at a football match. It's, you know, it's quite boisterous. It's quite volatile. And it's hugely kind of engaging and intoxicating. So I thought it was really important to leave significant amounts of that intact. And then even when we were playing, we would duck down the crowd noise, you know, to create a context for the music, but it still has to maintain a presence. You know, like I think it's a really important part of the sound world. And I didn't want to totally negate it. Now, as we head towards the end of the film, and actually the piece of music you just played is that kind of piece that plays out over an extended period towards the end of the film, we do duck the crowd noise a little bit more than we would have previously in the film, just to make the focus a little bit more on Best himself, and to kind of, I guess, invite people to kind of be even a little bit more reflective, take them out of the match and more into that kind of reflective, meditative mode. And it's amazing how it just becomes a different film for different people, you know, as they sit and watch it and, you know, their relationship with him or understanding, you know, of his place within, you know, football and culture. I often think back to when I was a kid in the 80s. I remember seeing George Best on The Late Late Show. And Gay Byrne asked him, who's the greatest footballer, you know, that's ever graced, you know, the football field. And Beth said, well, Pele said I was, and that's good enough for me.
And speaking of The Late Late Show and audiences and whatnot, who do you think your audience will be for this?
I think we will get some serious football aficionados. I think we will get, you know, some Manchester United fans. It's quite an assembly of musicians from the kind of contemporary classical and kind of jazz and improvised music community here in Dublin. And I think there'll be a lot of people who know our music and know what we do will be kind of peering in to see what we're going to do. And after that, I'm not actually sure.
Sure, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, we will absolutely, like, it will be that again, because it's such an unusual collision of, you know, the kind of avant-garde and the esoteric in terms of film culture. You know, we know what we're doing musically, and, you know, the compositions and the you know, the our approach, we've kind of been very clear about what it is that we're trying to do. But, you know, we're hoping Man U fans come, you know, people who love Best, because for this is, you know, there's a huge amount of kind of emotional investment in this for me. And that's kind of who I'd like to see kind of turn out. Yeah. You know, so fingers crossed they will come and partake of this.
The very best of luck with it. Matthew Nolan, thank you so much for joining me this evening. Football as Never Before, a celebration of George Best, will take place at the National Concert Hall in Dublin on Monday evening, which is the eve of the 20th anniversary of the death of one of the greatest players the world has ever seen, George Best. Live music will be performed by a wonderful ensemble of musicians. Matthew Nolan and Brian O'Connell are the composers. And for more details, just go to nch.ie. Let's have a listen to 11 Down. That is it for Arena this evening. Research was by Leah Murphy. Our broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Paul Murnock was on sound, and the programme was produced by Reg Leiby. Join us tomorrow for album and TV reviews at 7. The wonderful John Creedon is up next after the news.